From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Woody plants, especially trees, can be pure ecological powerhouses, but most of us don't have room for an entire forest in our backyards. So on a garden scale, which shrubs in particular really get the job done best? Dan Wilder, a longtime native plant expert who is director of applied ecology for Norcross Wildlife Foundation in Massachusetts, is here to talk about just that. More in a moment, but first, these messages.
Underwriting support for Away to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners on the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
Today's guest, Dan Wilder, urges us to make room for more shrubs in our landscapes to support burrs and caterpillars and other animals, while at the same time getting to enjoy their beauty in flower, in fruit, and even in showy fall color that some of his favorite species boasts. In addition to his work at Norcross Wildlife Foundation in Wales, Massachusetts, and its 8,000-acre sanctuary, Dan's a board member of the Ecological Landscape Alliance and also co-author with Mark Richardson of the book Native Plants for New England Gardens. Welcome back to the program. It's good to talk to you again.
Well, thank you so much, Margaret. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
And happy spring, I guess. It's finally spring.
Yes, it's finally spring. Things are coming out of the ground. The buds are starting to look green. I'm so excited. It's been a kind of a quiet, slow spring, but now's a good time.
Yes. So as I said in the introduction, I mean, woody plants are such strong performers in so many ways ecologically, but some of them are really big. But the shrubs, I think it's just this untapped, I mean, they're just my favorite plants of all, I guess. And I feel lucky that in the beginning when I started making my garden, I had sort of a natural affinity for them and added lots and lots, which are now even bigger than ever. And they do a lot of work, don't they?
Yeah, they definitely do. Your intro set us up perfectly. I'm an ecologist by trade, and so I'm constantly looking at, you know, what we can do on the landscape to make the landscape more ecologically viable. And when I look at the lists of trees or look at the lists of plants for birds, for bees, for, you know, caterpillars, it's oak trees, it's willow trees, it's cherry trees, it's all the trees, and they're so important. But, you know, that might work for me at Norcross, where we've got a lot of land to work with. But then when I talk to my neighbor who's got a half acre lot, and I say, hey, go plant like 40 oak trees, you know, that's not realistic. It doesn't work for a lot of people. And I find that, you know, shrubs are kind of, as you mentioned, a bit. It's not that they're not being used, but I don't think they're being used to their full potential. You know, most gardens, you get your shrub specimens in what is otherwise a herbaceous garden. And yes, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But I think we're doing that almost because we don't realize that it could be a shrub garden, you know, with some herbaceous plants mixed in as well. And maybe a few trees. And, you know, they're very, very adaptable and frankly range from as big of a tree to smaller than most herbaceous plants. So they really can do just about anything. It's really just a lack of kind of what we've done with these plants in the past. I think they have a lot more to offer.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And my garden, quote unquote, because it's not like a fancy formal place, you know, Versailles it is not, you know, the palace at Versailles it is not. Yes. But it's really an assortment of very, very large shrub borders, just sort of islands, many of them sort of near the edges of the property that are filled with shrubs, a diversity of shrubs. And I'm telling you, the birds from the beginning and now as the shrubs have matured, they know where the action is and that's where they visit. And I'll get whole flocks of, you know, whether it's cedar waxwings or robins or some other kind of thrush or whatever, you know, it's like everybody knows where the goodies are in those big shrub borders. And it's less mowing those areas because they are not turf. They could be turf. They're adjacent to turf. but I kind of carved them out and planted them with shrubs. So that's the other thing is they're not meadows. I didn't turn my lawn into meadow, but it's shrub borders. That's an alternative to what to do with some of our useless lawn, right?
Oh, certainly. And I've seen your garden. It's fantastic. I wish I'd had the instincts you did when I was first planting mine. I think I was too busy planting a bunch of, non-native perennials and I don't know, planting burning bush and pruning it into a meatball.
I did some of these things too, Dan, really, trust
It's I mean,
me.
we all have to learn. It's, anytime anyone
Absolutely.
gets on their high horse and tells you you're doing it wrong, it's like, I know I learn through mistakes, more effectively than I learn through my successes. And I think what you really hit the nail kind of nicely there is whether it be the useless lawn or whether it be the Versailles style garden or anything approaching that, gardens can be a very high maintenance thing, and for some people that's what they're looking for. But I'm a lazy gardener. I like to just kind of walk out and look at the beauty that is my garden and think, oh my God, this looks amazing, and I haven't actually had to do much to do to accomplish this. And so I find myself often working with plants that are really kind of the tried and true species, ones that tend to spread more vigorously than I think a lot of kind of more delicate gardeners prefer. And I love working with the woody shrubs because they're just, you get them established and then you just kind of forget about them and enjoy
Right.
them. And as you mentioned, the bird interactions, you'll find birds on your herbaceous plants. It's not that they're not playing a role, but bird interactions on shrubs are through the roof. I used to always talk to bird folks, and a lot of people would, put a bird feeder out on their lawn, and they'd enjoy seeing a few birds. And I would regularly tell them, I said, you know what, go put that bird feeder by the shrub border or under the tree, or maybe even just plant a few shrubs around it. And the amount of bird visitation just goes through the roof.
Yes.
It's not just the shrub itself that the birds are maybe eating or eating the insects in, but it's great protective cover.
Yeah.
Little birds need that. And so you see so much more because of it.
So if we're going to add shrubs, are there particular ones that you would, whether particular genera of plants or, I mean, you and I are both in the Northeast, and some of this will have to be adapted by people listening from elsewhere to a sort of parallel species native to their area. But, genus by genus, are there some like real home run kinds of plants that you want to recommend, or where do we
Definitely.
begin?
I mean, and as you mentioned, I'm an East Coaster, so I'll throw some of my favorite species at folks. But a lot of these are genera that are pretty common across the country and
Yeah.
frankly even outside of the country. So I might say bird cherry, which is often usually more referred to as choke cherry, but I never liked the name. That's Prunus virginiana, fantastic plant in my region. And if you're on the West Coast, I'm quite confident there's a shrubby cherry out your way that would do just as well for you. I'll back us up a quick moment though and say that, do what works on your landscape. I might tell you that I really like Bebb's willow, and if you've got a dry site, that's a terrible choice. It likes wet areas.
Right.
So find the plants that work well for you. But the ones that jump out to me immediately are I love the shrubby cherries. I think they're really underutilized. For some reason, my local choke cherry has a reputation for being weedy and kind of overly vigorous, and I have never found it to spread nearly as quickly as I wanted it to. I think it's just kind of got a bad rap. I'll throw willows in the mix. I have a soft spot for the upland dry-loving willows. In general, willows tend to like it wet, but there's some real standouts for the kind of, the drier sites. There's a dwarf prairie willow that I'm absolutely obsessed with these days. That's a lovely kind of short, slowly colonizing willow that grows well in sandy sites and is just loved by bees and caterpillars and birds and everything else.
What species is that one? Dwarf
That.
prairie willow.
It's well, it depends on which taxonomist you feel like arguing with that day.
Okay.
I've heard it most commonly. So when I worked at Native Plant Trust, it was going under the name Salix occidentalis, which I think is probably most accurate. I've also seen it listed as Salix humulus variety. Oh, I want to say Tristy. It's a variety of humulus, which is the prairie willow. This is the dwarf prairie willow. But as a, especially with our kind of, audience from all over the place, take a look at the willows and don't assume that they all like it wet. Though if you have a wet area, willows are fantastic. You have lots of choices. Look at some of these
Right.
dry-loving willows. There's some really cool ones out there.
Right. And they tend to have offerings besides being fun to look at. A lot of them are attractive. They tend to, some of them wake up early and, do a lot of service early on when,
Oh, definitely.
which is really wonderful to stretch that season of, offering resources to insects and so forth.
Yeah, as much as it's important to be feeding, insects through the summer, through the season, I find oftentimes I make a point of focusing on spring and fall because they're the easier ones to miss, and I'd want to make sure not to miss them.
Right.
And willows are fantastic for that. I'll throw blueberries in that mix too. We tend to think of the berries when we think of blueberries, kind of a summer thing, but the flowers that appear in the spring are essential bee food, including for a lot of really specialized kind of blueberry loving bees. And they're, and then, might not be very, ecological in terms of its fall kind of use, although there's definitely value there. But the fall foliage on it, thinking about my garden aesthetic, the blueberry fall foliage, rivals a burning bush any day. And who's not going to enjoy the berries in the midsummer? I think we need to give blueberries a little more of a look beyond just their berry value, which is very high. The flowers
Yeah.
and fall foliage is also fantastic.
And I don't know that I've ever actually eaten a blueberry that I've grown, but I have many, many, many blueberry bushes that I've had for many, many years. But everybody else gets to the fruit. But I don't cultivate them like a farmer would or even a, food gardener would. They're kind of tucked in here and there among other shrubs, again, in some of these shrub borders. They're always where the action is. And it could be a chipmunk one day and birds the next day. But the pollinators at the flowering time, and the flowers are just tiny little white, they're kind of inconspicuous, but you can tell they're flowering even from a distance because of the sound you'll hear.
Yeah,
It's
that lovely
really
buzzing
busy,
sound.
right?
I absolutely love that. I'm the same way with my service berries. Plant of many names: service berry, shad bush, June berry, shad blow. It's all the same thing. Amelanchier is the genus, and
Yeah.
I have planted and grown so many of these, and I think I've maybe eaten a half dozen berries in all of my time.
Right.
They're the absolute first one the birds get. And it's great. It's one day I might eat a few more berries, and in the meantime, I see all these birds flying around, and I'm very happy to not be eating my berries because of all the other benefits I'm getting from this. I think that's an underutilized genus, the service berry genus.
And
There's
they
real
can have
standouts there.
fall color too, I think. Yes.
Yeah,
Yeah.
amazing. A showier flower in spring than the blueberries, a
Yes.
berry that is arguably just as tasty, and then really amazing fall color.
Yes.
And
Yeah.
unlike the blueberries, they don't need the acidic soil, which really
Right.
opens up their ability for a lot of kind of urban growers and people who might not have the acidic soil that I'm used to in New England.
Right. Right. But boy, some of the blueberries, some of the low bush blueberries, especially that I've grown, I mean, my goodness, the red of that foliage.
Oh,
And it's
yeah.
the foliage is a thicker texture, so it's almost glossy. Do you know what I mean? It's
Yeah,
at
definitely.
that time, it's just wow.
Of all the blueberries, I think low bush is the most underutilized.
Yes.
I treat low bush in many cases like a filler in between other plants on the
Exactly.
landscape. And it you might look at one of my gardens and be like, there is more low bush blueberry in this garden than anything else, including all the herbaceous plants. It is just, I love the idea of a blueberry barren or a blueberry heathland or a blueberry sort of ecosystem. And I can take clues from those kind of wild types that I'll find, kind of out in the natural, kind of zone, and take that into the garden and be like, all of my high bush blueberries are underplanted with low bush blueberries. All my service berries are underplanted with low bush blueberries.
Yes, I
And
have
being
them
the nerd that
under,
I am, I get into there's a bunch of different species of both high bush and low bush blueberries beyond the common ones that we're most familiar with. So you can really delve into this if you want to get, completely about it.
The genus Vaccinium is a powerhouse for
Yes.
sure, right? So do some homework on that. Yes, absolutely.
Here, here.
Yeah. So blueberries were definitely voting two very strong positive votes for thumbs up,
Yes.
thumbs up. What other what other particular or any other genus that you want to shout out?
Let me throw two at you that I like to think of almost in a herbaceous manner. Those would be our dogwoods and the native spiraeas. And what I mean by that is I will often incorporate those two genera, dogwood and spiraea, into my herbaceous plantings, often into meadow style plantings. And what I like about those, and I'll throw willows into this mix, although we've already mentioned them, is that you can cut these things right to the ground really at any time you might want, and they will handle that and sprout up from the roots again. And it makes them very useful in a lot of landscapes where you might want kind of the value of a woody species, but also have the option to manage it in a more kind of cutback perennial manner. It's particularly useful in meadows, as I mentioned, but also under drip lines on houses where you might get like a heavy snowpack that smashes up your shrubs. You still want that kind of structure, but it might get kind of damaged over the winter, and you come by in spring and it looks pretty bedraggled. And it's nice to know it's like, okay, I can just cut this whole darn thing down. It's going to grow right back from that, no problem. And there also happen to be, ecological powerhouses, and I think the one that's popping in my head is a species called steeplebush. It's Spiraea tomentosa in my region. It's got these lovely pink kind of spiky flowers that mature into kind of a maroon burgundy and eventually turn, brown and dry and stand on the shrub. This I don't know why this plant isn't more popular. It grows anywhere from wet to dry. It doesn't get any taller than about 3.5, 4 feet tall. You can cut the thing down if you want to, or just leave it up. It's an ecological powerhouse, and it's got a flower that is not too dissimilar from something like a lilac. It's really showy. And every time I go to the nursery, I see a bunch of non-native spiraeas. And no knock against them, but I don't think any of them have anything to hold on our native spiraea, and they definitely have ecological value.
I looked on the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center
It's a great
website
source.
where they have the plant search, and if you
Yeah.
just put in the genus name, for the spiraea, you just put in the genus name. I mean, it's just interesting to see these native species, and as you say, at the garden center, we never see these native species. For
No.
yeah, so that's another one that's just kind of an eye opener to think about that we can add that's beautiful as well as does a lot of service ecologically. So.
Definitely. I think we need more attention to some of these underutilized species. Some of them are a
Yeah.
little odd and a little hard to kind of, find the right spot for. I'm thinking of some like, mountaintop willows that I'm really into, but ones like Spiraea tomentosa or, our native, there's a gray dogwood that doesn't have the same color of the twigs as like the red twig dogwoods, but the flower is showier, the berry is more consistent, and it's never used in the landscape. And I think we need to spend a little more time kind of exploring some of these shrubs. They're fantastic in the wild, and from the ecological point of view, it doesn't need to look good to be successful. But I think there's a lot to be said for kind of garden use of a lot of these species that we might run across in the wild and never see in the nursery.
Yeah, I have a lot of the red twig dogwoods, and I really love them. Excuse me, in the winter especially. I mean, for me, selfishly, it's just a joy to look out at them.
Yeah, that's something the shrubs offer that the herbaceous don't is, that late season interest, both the fall foliage, but also that winter interest. I mean, the red twig dogwoods are fantastic. Winterberry holly pops right into my mind. And then things like hydrangeas that give you a really cool dried flower that could kind of hang out all winter long. Like these, you don't tend to think of gardens in the winter quite the same way as we do, the other times of year, but there's some real standouts in the shrub world for the winter landscape.
The winter berries, I think I might have the national collection of No, I have a lot of winter berries now for some reason, and I really have no idea why. I bought maybe enough for four big groups, maybe 10 or 12 shrubs in each group, and this was, 30 something years ago. The sited each group, each border is sort of on access from a key window in the house, so that I imagined looking out at these
Nice.
big scenes of red fruit, at a distance, and they're all at a great distance from the house, and now they've become gigantic, after all those years of growing. But the only thing is that there's all these birds that know my address, and they don't really want me to see them in winter. They want to eat them in fall. So once you get on the map of the birds, fall visiting, forget about it. It's like now one thing is that they also come with yellowish and yellowish orange fruit, paler colored fruit, and those fruits will not be eaten as early or as quickly by the birds. So if you want to have selfish, a bit of a selfish thing going on, where you have one group that you get to stare at longer that lasts into maybe January or February, pick one of the lighter colored fruits, not the red ones.
I think you've done it perfectly, where you've got, the stuff that the birds really want, and you've got a good kind of ecological garden going, but then you've also got some that you get to enjoy yourself before the
Yes.
birds get to them, and that's perfect. I think that's a realistic way of kind of gardening a landscape.
And of course I'm happy when they come and visit. When a whole flock again of like waxwings or something comes in and there's no greater joy. So,
Yeah, that's
job
always
done,
fun.
right?
But I do get a little skeptical when I go to the nursery and I see the winterberry that's advertised as berries that'll last throughout the entire winter, and I'm like, oh, that means the birds don't want to eat them. What's
Right.
going on with this shrub?
Right,
Is
right,
that
right.
really what I want on my landscape?
Right.
And then, getting kind of realistic, if that is what you want on the landscape, go ahead and plant it. Plant some of the wild types as well, and you get the best of both worlds, and you don't have to feel guilty about it. You get to enjoy and also feed the birds. It's great to be able to kind of do it all.
Right. What about viburnums? Do you use any viburnums?
Oh, I absolutely love the viburnums. What I always dig about the viburnums is you name the habitat, whether it be sunny, shady, dry, wet, there is a viburnum species, often a few, that grow well in that type of habitat. So instead of telling you I really like, say, the nanny berry viburnum or the maple leaf viburnum, what I'll do when I'm talking to someone is say, what is your landscape? Where are you growing? What are the conditions? And there's always a viburnum that fits. I've got some Viburnum prunifolium, the black haw, that's growing on a ridge top. It is full sun and dry soils. I've got cranberry bush viburnum growing in full sun and wet soils. I've got maple leaf viburnum in the full shade, dry soils. I mean, it's just
Yes.
like different species for different sites. It's amazing how much diversity there is within that genus. And like a lot of the others we've been talking about, they are ecological powerhouses.
Yes.
Especially those blue-berried ones. The berries are chock full of carbohydrates, which is something that is really valuable for the birds. Kind of they're eating them in the late fall. That's when most of them are ripening, and that's kind of right before, the cold season. So getting a really nutritious berry then is really important. And
Right.
so I always tend to favor those.
I also have besides, and I have quite a number of those as well. And they do have the flowering, the attractive flowers, and then they have their fruit. And many of them have a kind of wine colored or darker fall foliage, which is great. I also have a lot of aronias, the choke berries. Is that right? Is that what I meant to say? Choke
Yeah,
berries.
yep.
Yeah, aronias. And those have great fall color, and that fruit is ripens very, very, very late. So that's feeding creatures at a different time. But I like those as well. And those flower, those are popular among the insects when they flower as well. At least they seem to be. So I enjoy those too, and they're easy to
Yeah.
grow.
I agree. Those are I'm glad to, hear more people talking about the aronias lately, but they're another kind of they're not as underutilized as some of the others, but definitely are still in that underutilized category. I
Yeah.
think we need a name change.
I
Chokeberry
know.
is just not a great name, and it's kind of funny. I was looking I was in the supermarket the other day, buying juices, and I'm realizing that Ocean Spray grows a bunch of or incorporates a bunch of chokeberry juice into a lot of their juice mixes. Very, very high in antioxidants.
Oh.
They don't call it chokeberry. They call it aronia berry.
Oh.
And the genus is aronia. And
Right.
when I looked it up, I see all this stuff about how aronia is a new superfood. And I think it's getting a bit of a PR campaign that it
Interesting.
deserves.
Interesting.
Do you
We
grow the
haven't.
black one or the red one
I have
or
both,
just
but
entirely?
yeah, both. A lot of the black one, though. And again, the foliage has great fall color.
Yeah.
We have maybe 3 minutes left, and I wanted to just do you quickly want to shout out any more plants? I know you grow. You're a lover of sweet fern, Comptonia,
Oh
which
yeah,
is an
sweet fern is
unusual thing, and it's
amazing.
not a fern. It's a flowering plant.
It's a shrub. It produces an actual, fruit, although it doesn't really look like a typical one, and it smells like cinnamon toast crunch. I love it on trail edges or areas. It's a tough plant. I'll plant it on the edges of my walking paths that every now and then we'll actually drive an ATV or a UTV over, and we go crushing all the sweet fern, and it comes right back from it. But meanwhile, while we're driving through it, the whole area just smells like cinnamon. A few others I will quickly throw out your way while we got the moment. A few that are so we hear about oaks and the value of oaks. Obviously, most oaks are trees. There is such a thing as a shrubby oak. It's called the scrub oak. It's a really funky, gnarly, cool species that is worth putting on your maybe list if you've never discovered it before. And there's a chestnut called the chinkapin chestnut, which is native a little bit south of my region, but grows just fine around here. It does get affected by chestnut blight, but not nearly as badly as the American chestnut. And while the blight is slowly killing stems of it, there's constantly new stems coming up, flowers and fruit forming. Some really amazing kind of specialized bee interactions on that shrub, and one that I think could use a little more attention. It's a new one for me, and I've gotten really excited about it lately.
Interesting. Yeah, from other areas of the country, I have, a lot of ninebark, the physocarpus.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
And witch hazel, we haven't mentioned yet, one of the
Well, and
truly
wow.
deer-proof, shrubs out there.
The sweet fern is deer-proof too, I think,
Yeah,
but the witch
the sweet
hazel is
fern is,
definitely,
and the spiraeas for that matter. And I find the deer will eat the blueberry berries, but they rarely actually eat the shrub itself, which is quite nice.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
While we're at it, the bird cherry, that choke cherry we talked about, I don't think I've ever seen deer eat that one. I want to check that one
Interesting.
with some other folks, but I don't recall ever seeing deer browsing on that one either.
Yeah. So basically, what we're advocating is make some shrub borders.
Yeah, plant more shrubs.
Formal or informal, loose, or I mean, it can be, they can be a privacy screen, they can, be a boundary along the road, they can be an ornamental garden of their own within your property. Use your creativity. Yes, I mean, it can be
Yeah,
anything.
they can be a filler in between your plants. They can be a cutback in some places. I mean, we could even go wild and say plant some red maple trees and cut them back into shrubs, and we could start getting really broad with this. But there's, don't let your imagination guide you. I think there's a lot more that shrubs can, do in the landscape than we tend to think of. Start thinking crazy and have some fun with it.
All right. Well, thank you, Dan Wilder, from Norcross. It's good to talk to you again. It's been too long. So thank you for making time today.
Oh, definitely, Margaret. Always a pleasure. Come visit me at Norcross sometime. You've got the Winterberry garden. I have an American holly grove I need to show you. It's
Oh, cool.
wild.
Okay. Thank you. I'll talk to you again soon, I hope.
Definitely. Be well.
Bye-bye. And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as at awaytogarden. And happy gardening with shrubs meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners on the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, HighMowingSeeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, WhiteFlowerFarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of AwayToGarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.